What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hi, I'm Lauren Good, Senior Tech Editor at The Verge, and you're listening to Too Embarrassed to Ask, a podcast where we answer all of your embarrassing questions about technology. It could be about what's going on at Uber right now. It could be about basic privacy measures you should be taking to protect your online information. It could be about which new smartphone to buy or whether the Samsung Galaxy S8 is going to explode. But we try to answer them all, so send us your questions. You can find my regular co-host, Kara Swisher, and me on the Twitter, and tweet your questions to us at @recode or to me directly with the hashtag TooEmbarrassed. We also have an email address. It's tooembarrassed@recode.net. And just a friendly reminder that embarrassed has two R's and two S's. So my co-host Kara Swisher isn't here today. I think she was maybe mildly disgusted when I said that we were going to talk about wearables again. And so she quickly made other plans. But I had to take this opportunity to talk about wearables because Ray Maker is in town from Paris. And some of you may know who Ray is or know him by his blog, DC Rainmaker. And I have a feeling some of you do know who he is because he told me when he went running this morning along the Embarcadero in San Francisco, six people called out to him along his run. So he's definitely famous in the endurance sports world. But for those of you who don't know, Ray is a blogger and athlete who covers the world of endurance sports through the lens of computers, basically. He reviews every wrist wearable, every heart rate monitor, every bike computer, pedal pods, gloves, sports cameras, you name it. Ray has tried it. He's blogged about it. He's YouTubed about it. And in October of 2015, he gave up his day job. He did the dream and decided this is what he was going to do full time. He's based in Paris, but he happens to be in San Francisco this week. So we brought him in. Ray, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me on board.
I'm so excited. I tweeted multiple times about this and included many exclamation points.
There was a lot of exclamation points. So yes. It's justified, I think, right?
Yeah,
it's
I think so.
Wearables are great.
Yeah. I mean, I think it says a lot that you were running this morning and people were waving to you along.
Yeah, it was crazy. I didn't expect it the first time. It was like, really? And then it happened again and again. And yeah, it's just not something that happens at home in France. And I think it's because here people are obviously more tech focused, of course, than France isn't like a huge like wearable tech hub. Most normal people don't wear wearable tech there. And then the same for from an English speaking standpoint, my blog's primarily in English or all in English. And so the French aren't as comfortable in English as some other European countries. And so I don't have like a huge followership in there. So it's very rare. Like this weekend was the very first time in I think 5 years that someone's actually called me out in the middle of a ride by name in France. So here, like, I'm 12 hours on the ground and it's...
You're internet famous. People are probably also trying to look closely at your wrist to see if you're testing something they haven't seen before.
They all are. It's a nice part about France. I don't have to worry about that at all. Like I can like go incognito anywhere. But here it's like, no, everyone's looking at my wrist all the time.
So I actually want to put my Peter Kafka hat on for a moment. And that means that... So Peter Kafka runs another one of our podcasts, Recode Media. And he has people on all the time that are prominent in media, run their own media companies. And he just kind of asks them how they got started and what they're doing, you know, in their business. So I want to talk about you first before we got to all of the wearable stuff. Tell people how you got into this because you weren't always a full-time sports tech blogger.
Yeah, so I was in the technology space and kind of data center design and stuff like that. Over time, I had started a personal blog. I think like most people's personal blogs was mostly just here's what I ate and here's what I did. I mean, very, very, very kind of straightforward stuff. And then at one point, I had sent a big long email about a really old Polar watch actually to a bunch of coworkers that just was like my review of that watch and whether or not I liked or didn't like it and stuff. And
what year was this?
2007-ish.
So this was
almost 10 years
ago.
Long time ago.
Do you remember which Polar watch it was?
Not off the top of my head. No, it was non-GPS. It was just like a generic accelerometer-based kind of running watch. And it was a longish email by email standards and just kind of sent it to him and didn't think anything about it. And then a few months later, I started this blog about just random personal stuff. And one day I was like, didn't have a post. So I just copied and pasted the email into a post and called it review. And it became popular. And then the next time I got another GPS or the first GPS running watch, I did the same thing for the old Garmin 400-305, like that orange reddish GPS watch. And that happened again. And then before you know it, Google did its like search magic and people kept coming to the site for the review. And so I just kept on buying more sports tech stuff, and I would write reviews on it. And eventually it's kind of gotten a bit out of control now, and now it is what it is. But it's sports tech focused, but it's also sort of my life as well. It's like this blend of here's what I do on a day-to-day basis, here's what I did this weekend, and then here's the latest review on whatever wearable or action camera, whatever's out
there.
Yeah,
I saw you took a painting class recently.
Yeah, that went horrible for my particular painting.
Well, stick to the running, I suppose.
That's definitely true. I had, without question, the worst painting in that class.
Why did you call it DC Rainmaker?
So you know how, like, when you're signing up for your AOL screen name, you like tried your real name, it didn't really work, and then you kept on adding numbers, it didn't really work. And so I was living in DC at the time, and Rainmaker was taken, and then DC Rainmaker was taken. I'm like, well, DC Rainmaker. I tried that and it accepted it on Blogspot, which is where I started the blog, and so that's how it stuck. If I had known more than like three people would eventually read it, I probably would have chosen differently. Or if I'd known I moved to Paris, I probably would have chosen differently since I no longer live in DC. But yeah, it is what it is.
Was Rainmaker a nickname of yours growing up?
Since not at
your
all.
Your name is Raymaker?
No, I mean, every once in a while people would make like certainly the joke of Rainmaker versus Raymaker, but it wasn't like something I thought about. It
was just like you wake up and you're like, make it rain every day.
Exactly. I lived in Seattle, grew up in Seattle, so it was one of those things where I definitely was used to rain, but no, I didn't even... It literally was just process elimination of screen names like in the good old days. That's as simple as that.
Okay, so you start this blog. You're working as an IT consultant, and mm-hmm. you're building web frames and things like that. Mm-hmm. You moved to Paris.
Yep.
At what point did you say, all right, this blog, it's taking off. It's a real thing.
I would say like around... probably a little bit after I moved to Paris, around like 2012, 2013. I moved to Paris in 2012. And it was shortly after that I kind of realized this could be a real thing. But the thing is, I loved my day job. My day job was traveling 300,000 miles a year around the world. Like I could be in Brazil one week and Australia the next. And it was a lot of fun. So it wasn't like I wanted to leave. It was great. And then eventually you got to the point where it was just too much stuff. It was essentially balancing two full-time jobs plus helping out my wife with her bakery. And one of those things where you just couldn't do anymore. You're sleeping 4 hours a night and working constantly. So it was about 18 months or so before I left my full-time job that I got to the point where I'm like, okay, I'm going to do this. And then it took that 18 months to sort out visas and the bureaucracy of that in France to be able to actually make that cut. So when I finally left in October 2015, that was like, to me, I was over the hump of I'm leaving my job and now I'm doing this full time. But I think to some people are like, oh, was it a big shift? And it's like mentally I had already got past that 18 months prior. It just, it took so long to get there. And so by the time I got to that point, I was definitely excited to do something on my own. I think the biggest thing for me is it's gaining scheduling freedom. Even for something as simple as this podcast here, I wouldn't have had that in a full-time job because I could have been on a plane to Dubai the next day and mm-hmm. couldn't really control my schedule. I mean, obviously vacations and stuff, but just having a quick meeting, you're not really sure if you can do that if you have to respond to someone else.
When you were starting the blog, or when the blog started to get popular, were you coming into it thinking, okay, I'm an athlete, and I'm an athlete who happens to test these
yep.
technology devices? Or were you thinking, okay, I'm a technologist because I work in technology, and how can I apply that in some
way? I think
it
definitely from an athletic standpoint first, but with a pretty deep tech background. So it's, you know, explaining things and understanding why they are what they are. And I think that's one of the things that's made it useful for folks is that, you know, if I'm reviewing a product and something doesn't work, I want to know why it doesn't work. I'm not just going to simply go out and say, oh, this sucks because it doesn't work this way. But why was that decision made? From an engineering standpoint, you know, working for a software company, I understood like everything's done for a reason. There's no accidents and that kind of stuff. So I like to go back to companies and say, why did you do it this way? You know, even if I disagree with why they did it that way, I want to at least be able to explain why they did it. And I think that helps people understand things. If they understand why a decision was made, then they can maybe decide whether or not the product's right for them, or if that's, you know, the direction they want to go in.
Right. Instead of just kind of ranting about why it might be missing something, or why the battery life is poor, or whatever it might be.
Yeah, there's lots of trade-offs. And the battery life is a great example, right? If you were to compare something like the Apple Watch to a traditional fitness watch, you know, people are like, oh, the Apple Watch has a beautiful display. And it absolutely does. But that's the trade-off right there, is that your battery life is a day and a half or so, maybe 2 days. And, you know, a traditional fitness watch could be a month. And so understanding, that's a very simplistic, explanation of why those two might be different. But that kind of diving into those details is what I think people like.
You do all the testing yourself?
Yeah,
entirely yourself. Do you have a staff that helps you run the site?
No, I've got some web developers that help just from the tech side, which is somewhat funny coming from being a tech guy myself. But I've learned like I got to focus my time on something, and so I'd rather focus it on testing and doing that. And then hire people that just maintain the site and make sure it's up 24/7. My wife helps me write the newsletter, and I've got one guy that helps me do editing of my grammar and spelling. That's it. So,
what about ad sales?
No, it's actually funny. I've tried different ad companies over time, and I find the whole ad thing so frustrating. So, I block all the ads for companies that want to advertise with me or want to, product review. So, like a Garmin and Apple and Nike, all those companies can't advertise with me. And so, I ended up using Google AdSense because it just works. I don't have to think about it. I kind of tried other publishing, advertising type networks and
mm-hmm. Have ad you quality. Tried any of like the niche health and fitness?
Yeah,
ad
I tried one a couple. About a year and a half ago, and mm-hmm. I guess a year and a half ago, and it was one of those things that it sounds great in theory, but then when you get to execution of it, like to be able to sell through volume of say four million page views a month or whatever it is, it's actually really tough to get that kind of in that fitness realm, and then to still adhere to all the blocks that I have. So to be able to say no, I can't get an Adidas or an Under Armour because they all sell gadgets that I review, starts to limit your playing field quite a bit. And then you get low quality ads, and then readers complain because they're getting low quality ads, especially international folks. Since my site is split half and half from a readership standpoint between North America and international, it's something that you've got to pay attention to. And if they're getting crappy ads and people, ads with sound, all that kind of stuff, people will close a page and won't come back.
Absolutely. Yeah, it really can degrade the quality of your site and what you're trying to do. Is that what your traffic is, 4 million views a month?
Yeah, 3 to 4 million a month, depending on, in season, out of season, whether people are trying to buy what they're trying to buy. But yeah, that's roughly about the average.
And are you doing affiliate linking? I should know this.
Yeah. Affiliate. So yeah, people want to support the site. They can use Amazon and one or two other sites out there if they want to go ahead and buy stuff. And that's kind of the primary thing. And I don't really care whether you buy a Garmin watch or Suunto watch or an Apple watch, if you want to use the Amazon link and buy toilet paper, that is awesome. Like, just buy a lot of toilet paper. But it doesn't really matter to me what you buy, as long as most people, at least in the U.S. and a lot of other countries, will use that, and that helps.
Are you profitable?
Yeah, it works out pretty well.
And is that mostly through the affiliate business or through ad revenue?
It's a blend. I would say it's 70-80% affiliate, 20-30% ads. Ads slowly building up over time. As I got away from got back to AdSense, actually has turned out to be a pretty good thing. And then I think that's pretty much the majority of revenue. I mean, it's a pretty simple revenue stream between those two. It's
right.
Not a lot else out there.
How does YouTube do for you? I mean, I know you've been on YouTube for 8 years at least, and your videos have gotten a lot, I think, more sophisticated and everything over time.
YouTube money is trivial. It's literally not worth the time from my standpoint, which sounds silly, but like if I was purely from a business, like if I had a manager would look at me and say, Ray, you're stupid. Why are you wasting time on this? Because the revenue I get from YouTube isn't worth the time. Like, I mean, I could put out a 100,000 view video and get like $30 off of that. And it's just not worth it. But I still enjoy it. Like, so that's what's weird about it. I look at it and go, I think video is definitely the future of a lot of reviews, and it's where a lot of people are getting their content from. And I think, even though if I look purely at the YouTube dashboard on that revenue, that doesn't necessarily tell the whole story, because they could then be going onto my site, and then from there they could go on to buy something via Amazon, whatever else, and then I'm getting that revenue that way. So it's somewhat deceiving, but I like YouTube. I like the challenge of doing something different, video, and so that's probably the reason why I spend so much time on it. But yeah, it's tough sometimes. You sit there and like you'll spend all this time video editing because I do it all myself, and so I'll shoot the video, and then you'll find out you're missing like sound or something stupid, right? And you have to reshoot it again, and then you edit it. It spends hours, and then you go up and you're like, I made $6 in that video.
There's definitely, I mean, if you don't have a team of people who are helping you and you're spending, video production can take hours out of your day. We certainly go through that.
Things take so long to
do. They take a really long time.
They do.
And having worked both in digital video and now like just writing most of the time, it's amazing how different the processes are. Yeah. And you're also you're doing things that are essentially hard to produce. I mean, you're underwater, you're swimming, or you're on a bike.
Yeah,
or
it's not like in a room. Like, it's really tough. You have to, you're thinking about, I'm moving down the street at say 20 miles an hour on a bike. I'm shooting and I'm like, okay, what's my mic situation like? Can they hear me? Noise cancellation, syncing up of data, because I'm doing data overlays to show people what I want to see on this. It is complex, and it's one of those things like the error rate is really high. I was laughing. I probably only publish to YouTube like 10% of what I shoot from a video standpoint, which is an enormous waste of time when you think about how much time that takes to do all the video production and then never actually get to YouTube. But and I'm talking like B-roll and stuff. I'm talking like I had an idea and 10% of those ideas make it to YouTube just because somewhere along the way you go, wow, this is way too complex to edit now. Or, you know, if I have like four different cameras, like I was doing a bunch of drone videos and stuff. And, you know, I'm trying to show tracking of me using autonomous drone stuff. And you're like, okay, I've got
drones on drones on drones.
Literally, it's drones on drones. Like I've got drones following me, following the camera. And before I know it, I have five cameras and you're trying to sync all this stuff. And invariably, because it's autonomous drone stuff, it always goes wrong. And so you're taking multiple takes to try to get it right. And then, it's really funny, kind of a funny thing. You sit there and you just kind of go, wow, that's a lot just to show what should be a basic concept, like to show it does it work or does it not work. And especially like in drone videos, because then YouTube, like criticality factor is way higher than every other segment. And even when you want to show how bad something is, then people will tell you you did it wrong. And it's like, I've done this five times now and it doesn't work. It simply doesn't work.
You need to trust me on that. Yeah. I can't be a cheerleader for this particular thing. It doesn't work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's always the tough part is kind of explaining, you know, and finding that balance of what is something that I've done wrong versus something that the product simply doesn't work.
Right. Yeah, it's a very enthusiastic audience on YouTube for gadget reviews especially.
Yeah.
But when you have something negative to say, you can expect blowback even if you're completely founded in your opinion. And
yeah.
And it does take a lot of work. And you have to work out multiple times a day on top of that, and you're maintaining your blog. So it's not like you can just live this Casey Nesta existence where you're just like GoProing your entire life.
That'd be nice. Like I don't get me wrong, I do not envy Casey in any way, shape, or form from like a lifestyle standpoint. I think that's a lot of work. I'm sure he does a lot of work and he runs as well, right? He's a big runner.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely, there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. I mean, the majority of my day is answering emails. That's in comments. Like I spend 4 to 6 hours a day just responding to comments on the site, which you think about like how much time that is over the course of the day. Again, going back to like, is it worthwhile? And I think that is worthwhile because I think people find value in those comments. Like my, you know, a lot of Garmin reviews could have 3,000 comments on that review in terms of people that have responded and have questions and stuff. And so, yeah, from a search standpoint, that then gets into SEO and all that kind of stuff where it builds and that becomes the, you know, predominant result. So there's definitely value in responding to all that, but it's a lot of time.
I know you're on Twitter because it's how we first connected, but do you feel compelled to answer your fans, for lack of a better word, your audience on Snapchat, Instagram, all of those platforms?
So my wife gives me a really hard time about Instagram. She's like, you're the worst Instagram person ever. But I Instagrammed this morning, so I have checked off that list for at least another month. I have not got into Snapchat much, which I know sounds weird from a tech standpoint. I'm keenly aware of it. I follow exactly one person on Snapchat. But I'm just, you get to the point where you got to like focus on a channel and focus on whatever that is. So for me right now, that's my blog itself, it's Twitter, it's YouTube, and Facebook as well, Facebook pages, but that's it. Like I did a Google, pages for a while and stuff. And it's like, well, that there's no benefit to that. So I've eventually got to kind of, from a business standpoint, say that's not worth the time anymore. And, I'm sure there's a lot of value in Snapchat, for example, Instagram stories, but it's just one of those, there's only so many hours in the day. And how do you respond to people on all those channels?
So what is a typical day for you, like aside from answering emails? When you're deciding what device you're going to be testing or devices, because I've seen you wear multiple watches at the same time, or what exercise you're going to do, what does your training schedule look like?
It's kind of messy. So my training schedule used to be more structured if I was training for a certain race, and I would have a various builds and all that kind of stuff and tapers, and it was very, very structured. Now it's sort of like just survival mode in the sense I'm training based on what I need to test. So if I have a bunch of bike stuff coming up, I'm focused on bike training. If I've got running stuff, it's run focused training. And I kind of switch back and forth depending on what I'm trying to accomplish from a testing standpoint. So that really gets into my day. I mean, my days, I think like a lot of other media outlets, are probably structured towards what releases are coming up. So what's embargoed news? What are timelines to hit? Like this week, there was two different, embargoed fitness things out there that I had to focus on to make sure that at that exact moment at, 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time yesterday, that a post hit and so on. So I definitely focus on that, and that kind of structures my week. And then if there's not something that's hitting my radar that week, then I'll try to fill in with other product reviews, and then that drives what workouts I'm doing. If I'm sitting there going, well, I've got a bike power meter, then I've got to what things do I have left to get on that test list? So have I got the outdoor rides that I want done? Have I got the indoor rides that I want done? Do I have certain types of testing I want done? And that'll drive what I'm doing that week.
Do you have any kind of lab or facility that you used for testing heart rate? And
yeah, so I've got what's called the DCR cave. So it's actually an underground cave, literally in France. It's underneath my wife's bakery. And so that's where I've got tons of trainers and gear and equipment that I can test things. But really, I use me and myself, like in terms of my body, as that test vehicle. So certainly over the next few weeks while I'm here in the States, I'll be testing tons of things. I'm just a mobile test lab, and I brought a ton of stuff. I mean, half of my suitcase was gear to test or to support testing. So
you really set off all the flags at TSA.
Oh, they hate me so much. My baggage is always delayed. Always, always, always delayed. It's just, it's really bad. They want to take everything apart, and it's a mess. I think it's really important to be an athlete when you're testing things. Like, there's a ton of equipment out there that can simulate an athlete, but it's still not an athlete. It's still not a person. It still doesn't act like a person. Like, I was listening to somebody the other day talking about bike power meters, and bike power meters measure essentially how much effort that you're putting into a bike in a very quantifiable way. And they were talking about a dyno, basically a utility, to be able to measure a certain amount of, or drive a certain amount of effort into a bike to be able to produce and say, if this bike is producing 300 watts, then is the power meter measuring that exactly? And that's great. But in today's world, that's not where bicycle power meters fail. They fail outdoors on, you know, environments with high temperature, low temperature, with humidity, with cobblestones, rough roads. And so that's where I want to focus testing I'll go indoors and do all the basics, but I want to make sure I'm testing things that are tougher. And the same is true with optical heart rate sensors and stuff that, you know, it's easy to sit on a spin bike and get an accurate optical heart rate, but then go for an outdoor ride on a rough road or go for a hard run up and down stairs, like that kind of stuff.
Sort of the pendulum motion of your arms and things moving around and, you know, light changing and all of that in order to really see, or even just, you know, a human being going for a run and looking down at a watch and going through the data pages and figuring out if that UI is intuitive enough to cycle through when you're actually, you know, running, like maxing yourself out. Yep. It's not something that a robot can simulate.
No, you just got to put in the miles, I guess. It's the simplest thing.
Mm-hmm. What do you eat?
Everything.
Do people ask you that a lot?
Yeah, I think it's funny because I'm sure folks look at me and they're like, he knows everything about athletics and stuff and nutrition and all these sort of things. And certainly I'm very...
You're like, my wife owns a bakery.
Yeah, exactly.
I just go there.
She makes cakes for a living. I test and eat cakes. I mean, that's my deal. It's the only reason why I run is to eat more cake. So it's pretty... I eat anything. I'm happy to have a burger. I had Chipotle last night for dinner. It was like one of those like, great, done. Living in Paris, obviously you become foodies. The food is seen as incredible there. And so there's a lot of that we enjoy. But at the same time, like, I'm also happy to have a Five Guys burger in Paris too, because now we have the world's largest Five Guys in Paris. So it's great.
Really? Is that really a thing?
Really, it's true. The world's largest Chipotle and the world's largest Five Guys are both in Paris.
Yeah. I wouldn't think that in
It's
Paris.
Five stories.
I would think that in like Times Square, New York City.
Yeah,
but
it's crazy.
Wow. Yep. Five stories of Five Guys French fries. I think I could get behind that.
It's
incredible. Do you don't have a caloric threshold that you're saying like, I want to hit this each day because I did X number of workouts?
Nothing. No, I think, I used to do like a lot of calorie counting and stuff, and I used to weigh a whole lot more before I started training for my first marathon, but I just try to keep it balanced. You know, I think like anyone else, you go up and down depending on the seasons and stuff. And so like most people, you tend to weigh a little more in the winter and a little less in the summer. And I try to keep it balanced. And certainly living in Europe helps out I walk everywhere. I don't have a car. So, putting down 10 or 15,000 steps in a day is pretty straightforward and pretty easy.
It is. It's incredibly helpful. Yep. We don't quite have that in the Bay Area. Well, some people do. I mean, in the city directly, but there's a lot of traffic here right now, which is one of the biggest change for me when I moved from New York City out here. But anyway, so stumbled upon this blog post on DC Rainmaker not long ago. Other people had seen this because it was old, and I just happened to see it. We emailed about it. You got stung by a stingray at one point when you were testing. Was it a polar? You were testing
polar,
it was the V800.
V800, yep.
In Florida. Mm-hmm. You happened to be in Florida. And it horrified me for a multitude of reasons, because it sounds like you were in terrible pain. So that's the worst thing. But also, like, I've just taken up surfing again. And so stingrays are, among other things, one of the things that are like on my mind. And I was curious as to whether that was the craziest thing that's ever happened to you while you've been training or testing something for the blog, or if there's something else.
I'd say that's pretty high up there. I was hit by a car in the middle of a race.
Oh, no.
So that was definitely up there, too. In a triathlon a couple years ago. I was just on the course riding along, and a car ran through a stop sign and T-boned me. And so I went flying off, but I actually finished the race. So after the ambulance came and everything else, I thought it was a good idea at the time. It was actually a horrible idea. I'd broken my femur.
And finished the race. How many more miles did you have to go?
I had to only bike another 2 miles, and then I had to run a 10K. And I actually ran one of my fastest 10Ks ever. But I couldn't walk the next
day.
With a broken femur, but I couldn't walk the next day. It was, or for a lot of days.
Were you concerned at all about internal bleeding or anything?
No, that would have been logical. I mean, know this, like if you're in a race, like you don't really think about this. You're like, I'm only 2 miles from the end of the bike, and then running's fine. Like it'll be all fine, despite the fact my bike was like cracked and like it didn't really roll very well. It was mostly downhill. It worked out, but it was just one of those. Yeah, looking back on it was definitely pretty stupid, but I checked it off.
So you've been hit by a car. You've been stung by a stingray directly in the foot.
Yep.
I like how, by the way, the bottom of that post, and everyone who's listening should go check this out, or maybe not if you have a terrible fear of stingrays because it's not going to help anything. But at the bottom, you did say that you had given your wife permission to take the photos of you sort of lying prone and not in a good space.
We have a bilateral policy that says that either of us can take those photos knowing that the other person will definitely want them later on in life. And so that was one of those scenarios that, even though I was basically passed out with a bunch of medical stuff being stuck into me on a beach with tourists looking over me. She took a couple snaps along the way. Yeah.
Anything else remarkable about your testing experiences?
No, I think it's interesting. Just, I mean, obviously there was those instances, which by the way, I almost got stung by another stingray, 2 months ago in Australia.
Oh, really?
While testing stuff, I was standing in the water, like taking photos of watches, just ready for start for swim. And I had finished all the photos of all these watches. And I looked down, and within 6 inches of my foot was a stingray right in front of me. So my next step would have been directly on top of it.
Ooh,
again.
That
I'm like,
would have
really?
Bad.
Would have been not
to
a good
do the stingray shuffle.
Again, yeah. And that was the worst part of the whole stingray thing, is that when I mentioned at one point in Florida, people were like, oh, you didn't do the stingray shuffle? I'm like, no, it's not mentioned when you come in the airplane. Like, welcome to Tampa, do the stingray shuffle. No, of course not. Like, why would I know this? I've lived in Seattle and D.C. Stingrays aren't a challenge there, like
right. It's not like you arrive at the beach and it says, you know, warning, rocks and sharks, and do the stingray shuffle, which
exactly.
would be really helpful in a lot of places, especially warm weather places. But the first surfing lesson I ever had, which by the way terrified me, it was in Costa Rica, and I was in way over my head, and I walked out and I didn't surf again for 4 years. I was told to do the stingray shuffle, and so that I learned very early on, if you're going to do water sports, you need to in the ocean, you need to do that.
No,
but unfortunately, you do know, because, and you know, for some people, it's been happening a lot. It seems anecdotally, people I talked to, it's been happening a lot more frequently. But in either case, what's the most number of wearables you've ever worn on your wrist at any given time while testing?
I would say on my wrists themselves, maybe like 7 or 8. I've kind of gotten away from it, putting like more than, I mean, look, with all the sensors, or all the wearables now having optical sensors, if you have more than one on the wrist, it tends to actually impact the other ones from an optical sensor standpoint, because it'll basically restrict blood flow, and then the second one doesn't pick it up correctly. And it's really easy to show and demonstrate. I even just did this weekend just for fun, just to kind of demonstrate how having two on the same wrist immediately has caught an impact there, as you're doing right there. And
two very different devices.
Two very different devices. Right, and you got a totally functional other wrist too that's empty. So
do that for my hair tie.
Yeah, important things.
Yeah.
But there's certainly, I have, like, if I'm going for a run, I'm trying to test GPS stuff, I'll put them on like a Camelback or something like that, another backpack to run with me. And so it's not unusual. I mean, most runs I have 4 watches with me in some way, shape, or form. Most bike rides I have 5 to 7 bike computers. I think at the top was like 14 bike computers on a bike at once. And the worst part, that was in the Alps. And so I was like up and down these massive mountains with all this extra weight on there, and then everyone look at me, of course all the French people look at me like, what are you doing? We don't even have one bike computer and you've got 14. What's wrong with you?
I have to say, as much as we miss Kara, we miss you. She would, by this point, Eric's laughing, she would have left the room. She would have been like, I can't handle this. We call her, she has a drawer of unwearables, because she, you know, she tries them out for a few months, and like a lot of other consumers, she ends up taking them off her wrist and ditching them, doesn't see the value in them. And I love to geek out on wearables. So if you were to choose just one watch right now that you would use.
It's tough. I'm not wearing any right now.
What's your go-to? You're not.
I know, it's weird.
That tells me you've been testing something that's top secret, by the way, the fact that you're not wearing anything. And I see like a tan line on your wrist. So
I am super, super like, not the right word is, but focused on knowing what's on my wrist at any one point in time, what the situation is. Like I know I'm keenly aware that people are always looking at my wrist, and depending on what I'm in, like, even like shooting videos and stuff, and not just necessarily products that may be unreleased, but just, I think it's right. Like if I'm shooting a video about one type of device, not to have like a competitor's device on my wrist at the same time, like that just looks weird. I don't think it's the right message to send. But to like focus on what I'm doing and what situations I'm in. At the same time, I'm testing stuff all the time, so I'm just going to wear what I'm going to wear. I think I was at a event last fall, and there was a bunch of Garmin folks there or something, and someone's like, you know, why are you wearing the Polar watch? Not like an accusatory standpoint, just like that's a lower end Polar watch, which is their competitor. And, you know, people look at your wrist and kind of assume that that's your preference. And I'm like, well, this is just what I'm testing right now. Mm-hmm. Like this is the watch du jour. I have to wear this today because I have to get the test data. And so that's generally where it is. Right now, I'm kind of in actually an odd point where, like, for just today, I don't have much going on the testing standpoint. I got tons of stuff starting tomorrow. I got stuff, like when I mentioned I was here in San Francisco, like Fitbit curried over a bunch of stuff last night to my hotel. So I have that. Like, all that kind of stuff is always going on. I just haven't had a chance to unbox it and put it on my wrist yet. As far as my daily one, I would say right now, if I had to pick one, it'd either be the Fenix 5 or the from Garmin or the 935 from Garmin. It's just
935 XT, yeah, the Forerunner that came out last year.
Yep.
It's so funny. Those would probably be my choices as well.
Yep.
I really liked the 935 XT last year, and then I just reviewed the 5S, the Garmin Fenix 5S, and I was really impressed by it.
Yeah, the 5S.
And I'm so happy they made something a little bit smaller for smaller wrists and or women.
Yep.
Oh, Walt Mossberg's calling me right now, but I'm going to just decline this for a moment. Or should I take the call from Walt during the podcast?
I think so.
Hey, Walt, I'm taping a podcast right now, and you're on the air.
Well, then you probably shouldn't be talking to me.
I just wanted to say hi.
Very nice of you, but you should go back to taping.
Are you sure? So I've got a DC Rainmaker in the studio, and Kara's not here because I think her head was going to explode if we talked about wearables anymore, but Rainmaker runs one of the best tech and fitness blogs out there, so he's here.
Okay, cool. Well, then say hi, do the podcast. I'm just calling to check in. We haven't talked, I think, since your trip, and I thought we would catch up a little.
Okay, sounds good. I'll call you later.
See ya.
Bye. So what were we saying? Oh, we were talking about the Garmin, the Fenix 5S,
yep.
And you reviewed the 5, obviously,
yep.
And gave it a thumbs up.
It's a solid watch. I think it's Garmin's best wearable they've ever made in terms of, like, they're getting to the point where the maturity level is so high now, and they're not starting from scratch every time. I think they've, from a product development standpoint, they've kind of merged all those resources now, and they're actually building upon their past products, as opposed to, you know, a lot of products will do a whole reset every time. They'll release a new product, and you've got to wait for that product to mature, and it just takes so long. They're at the point now where they're releasing quick enough that, I mean, kind of like the iPhone or a lot of other things where, you know, when you go from version to version, you're not seeing like going backwards in time, whereas it's true for a lot of products. They go backwards for a few months, and then you have to go forward. And I think Garmin's got to the point where they're mature enough now that they're just legitimately going forward for the most part. And that backwards period is either non-existent or just a couple weeks before the last, you know, minor firmware stuff goes out. And so, yeah, I really like that. My wife wears the 5S as well. She likes it. It's a really, really solid watch.
What do you think of Garmin software?
It's a mixed bag. I'm mixed on the app. I tweeted out the other day making fun of that runner man thing that pops up on the app every time it's thinking. And it's like, what are you thinking about? Just open up the app. Don't show anything if you're thinking. Like, just wait. And, you know, they've made a lot of good strides in the last couple of years. It's still their tougher spot. There's a long history as to why that is in terms of them laying off an entire team and all that kind of stuff that got them to where they are today. But I think they're getting a lot better than I think some folks give them credit for. I think if you compare them to a lot of the competitors, it's a mixed bag. Some people prefer mm-hmm. like Polar, some people prefer Suunto. And then if you look on the wearable side, especially, then you get to preference between Fitbit and them. I think for the average consumer buying, for example, an activity tracker, there's not a lot of difference between Fitbit and Garmin, for example, at the end of the day. It's one
really?
Of those.
I think there is.
From a hardware or software standpoint?
Oh, from a software standpoint, actually. Well, just in the sense that, so they both offer desktop software, but Garmin really started as pretty you know, granular desktop sure. software. And now it feels to me like they've just sort of condensed all of that information into a mobile app. And the fact that you have to swipe through 10 different pages to see your data when you open the mobile
definitely
app
true.
Is... But then, like you point out, I mean, I'm wearing the Suunto Spartan HR. I just started wearing it and opened up the Suunto Moves app. And it's got, like, I don't want to misquote this, but like 1.5 stars or 2.5 stars in the App Store. And it's like, it's all relative, right?
It is.
It's
yeah. It's all over the place. I think different apps do different things better than others. Like, I think Fitbit's social piece is way better than Garmin's social piece. Like, and that's definitely true. And I think some of their surfacing of information is a lot better than Garmin's. I think when you get into the athletic side, Garmin tends to do a better job at showing you that data that you want from an endurance standpoint or whatever. And that's really tough. Like Fitbit's in a little bit easier spot because they're not trying to cater to two vastly different audiences, right? Versus Garmin is trying to cater to someone who's not even going to run at all, just going to walk and wear this activity tracker at the same time as someone that could very well and is an Olympic athlete, right? They could be an Olympic athlete and a gold medalist that is trying to get very granular data. And so it's really tough to be that company for two different pieces. But I think even with that in mind, Garmin can do a heck of a lot better job on just like the dashboard page itself of some of these, of the app, just to be able to see that basic data.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of Apple Watch?
I think they make, without question, the best smartwatch out there, period, but not the best fitness watch.
And how do you define a smartwatch versus a smart fitness watch?
I think, so that's the definition that keeps on changing for everyone, including like IDC and others that track things. It's like every month it's a different definition of what's a smartwatch. I always laugh and I look at the rankings and stuff. You're like, wait a second, wasn't last month this wasn't included, now it is included? I don't understand that. I'm considering a smartwatch anything I get notifications on. And I know there's different definitions of one that has apps versus not apps, and it gets really granular. For me, though, I think the reason why it's so good is just the nuances. It's these nuances of the Apple Watch that when you wear it for a long time, you start to pick up on and how it reacts to you. And the example I always give in the Apple Watch is with text notifications, where a text message come in, I could be sitting like I am at a table with other people right now, and you don't see that text message on my wrist, even though you're 2 feet away from me. It shows blank. But then the second I show my wrist, it could be 5 minutes later, I then see the text message myself. Whereas with your Suunto right now, I'm seeing the text messages are coming in as they've been coming over the last half an hour on the display right then and there, because I see them. There's no like holding back until you're not in control of the watch anymore. And so I think it's that kind of stuff that's so nuanced that they do so well. But from a fitness standpoint, it starts to fall apart. And I think like it could be heart rate accuracy. There's even some quirks in GPS and in pace and things like that. And then just the reality of interfacing with something that doesn't really have buttons for the fitness side of it. Like there's buttons on the Apple Watch, but you can't actually use them in a fitness context. They're to get back to other menus and stuff like that. So it's a bit more tough than, you know, if you're doing a really hard interval out there and you're running as hard as you can, you want to mark a lap, that doing that on Apple Watch on a rainy night is really tough. Like
right.
It just doesn't work that well.
And you're also a triathlete. And there's no real triathlon mode on Apple Watch.
No, definitely not.
So you have to sort of stop and start and stop and start every time you're in a transition. And
exactly.
When you're shaving off seconds, that's not ideal, right?
Yeah.
I say this like I sound like I know it. I've done triathlons before. I've never done a triathlon.
What?
But
why not?
I should. I'm looking to sign up. I should sign up for a sprint. I'm going to start
sprints.
That. That's like this year. That's a this year, this summer goal.
Sprint
just do a sprint.
Sprint is like the playground crack of triathlon. Like it's, you basically go out, you do it, you have so much fun. You can still walk afterwards. Like it's great. It's like a marathon. You can't walk the next day. An Ironman, you can't walk the next day. It's the same thing like with someone once told me that like a half marathon is a very gentlemanly distance, that you can go out, you can run a half marathon, and most people can still go about the rest of their day with some degree of normalcy. Like they may be sore, they may be depending on how they ran it, but they're not lying on the couch looking up at the ceiling for 3 days.
Right. they're able to go to work the next day.
Exactly, they go to work.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Although
with the sprint.
Although I will say, every time I've done a half marathon, I've said to myself afterwards, I don't think that I could do two of these right now. So maybe a sprint is more my
sprint, they're so
style,
much fun.
And then I'll go for the try at some point. But yeah, I mean, with certain smartwatches, quote unquote, that seems to be the limitation. Like I just reviewed the LG Watch Sport, and it had this one really interesting feature where it will automatically recognize your strength training exercises, which didn't work all of the time. You know, sometimes it thought I was like chest pressing when mm-hmm. I was actually doing shoulder flies or whatever right. it might be, right? But that was really cool. And I thought, oh, well, and it has, you know, GPS and LTE mm-hmm. built in, but then the battery was terrible. So you're like, you think about how they're catering to athletes, you know, quote unquote serious athletes in one area. And then you think about that one critical area where you're making that trade-off and you're like, well, I would probably just get a Garmin or a Polar.
It's really tough when you get to that level. And I think, like, I saw that at one of the European tech trade shows as well. Like, I was looking in a booth for, I don't remember who it was, LG. It was one of the kind of the, I don't want to say legacy phone carriers, but one of the big phone carriers that had wearables. And you looked in the booth and you're looking at these ads or their, whatever you call the stuff in the booth, like booth photo stuff. And you're looking at it going, that doesn't make sense. Like, there's fundamentally, that's the wrong metric in sport. Like, they just, they clearly some ad person that said, oh, we'll just toss these metrics on running. And you're like, that's a cycling metric. Why is it on running? Like, you don't use that that way. And I think it's really tough for those companies to bridge that gap into being sport focused. And it's something that certainly Apple has plenty of very capable athletes there, right? I mean, they're a big company. They have a lot of people that understand sport and fitness. But Apple's challenge is to be able to balance that with something that they want to sell millions of units of to a wide number of people. And there's nothing wrong with making that choice. Mm-hmm. I think it's tougher if you're marketing a sport watch, though, to be able to find that balance and make sure that the nuances are right in the sporting sense, because you'll get slaughtered for it. I mean, athletes will look at that and laugh and just move on to the next thing in the same way that, you know, people on the other side will look at a pure athletic watch and be like, well, that's stupid. I don't need all that stuff.
Right. Or I don't like the way it looks or something exactly. like that.
Yep.
I'm really glad that Apple added waterproofing, though. Definitely. To Series 2 and GPS. The waterproofing mechanism is pretty cool.
It's super cool to listen to and watch and all that stuff. It's fun. I did waterproofing tests on the first one. I put it in a waterproofing chamber and everything, and it held up. Like, there was definitely a fair amount of waterproofing they had done on that unit, but they were just being cautious, which is fine. Makes sense.
Okay, so in a minute, we're actually going to take some questions from Ray's fans, and he's going to answer them. But first, we have to go make some money. And Kara's not here today, so I will say her favorite word, which is ka-ching. Are you ready to take your website to the next level? Because whether you're a first-time blogger or an experienced web pro, HostGator has all the tools you need to create a really great-looking website or even an online store. And if you ever need a boost in hosting power, HostGator offers cloud, VPS, and dedicated server hosting that can easily handle maximum visitor traffic. So see what HostGator can do for your website. And right now, you're lucky because Recode listeners get 60% off. You just have to go to HostGator.com/recode. That's HostGator.com/recode and get your 60% off.
This is brought to you by Willis Towers Watson. Executives, you need to listen to this. Cybersecurity is one of the greatest threats any business faces. Last year, more than 400 million new malware threats were released and more than a half a billion personal records were breached. And while businesses spend $100 billion a year on cyber technology, cybersecurity is as much about employee behaviors as it is technology. The average network breach can cost $4 million in company losses. That's why you need to know about Willis Towers Watson. Willis Towers Watson understands the only comprehensive approach to cybersecurity is to deal with it all, your people, your capital, and your technology risks. Willis Towers Watson decodes all that complexity through its comprehensive three-stage approach. First, they thoroughly assess the cyber risks throughout your businesses. Next, they protect your company through their best-in-class solutions. And finally, they let you improve your ability to recover from future attacks. Learn more about what Willis Towers Watson can do for your business. Go to willistowerswatson.com/recode. That's willistowerswatson.com/recode.
Okay, I think I have taken up enough of your time with my own questions. I should probably get to our reader questions since that is the point of this show. And anyone who's been listening this long is probably thinking, I'd really like it if she got to my questions now. So you all know how it works. Every week, we take tech questions from our readers and listeners, and we try to answer everything that we can. And this week, we're answering everything you could possibly want to know about health and fitness trackers with Ray Maker of DC Rainmaker fame. The first question is from @takenwithcamera. That's a good handle. How has his life changed since he quit his day job and is full time with the site?
The biggest thing is schedule. It's control of schedule. I think we talked a little bit this earlier, but it's just the ability to schedule time on my own terms and not have to worry about something else popping up or changing and canceling on stuff. And it sounds so trivial until you realize I can actually take a meeting with someone and not have to worry about it and know that that's my time. Beyond that, I still work a lot of hours. I still swim, bike, run. I still do all the stuff that everyone else does. It's just simply I can schedule my own time now.
Okay, so scheduling. There are perks to running your own thing.
Yes.
Yeah. You're kind of, you should like live the Brian Lamb life. You know Brian Lamb from The Wirecutter, right? Yep. Just like split your time between two exotic locations, go surfing from time to time, then eventually sell your site to the New York Times.
Yeah, it's funny. I've thought about it. Not necessarily to sell the site portion, though if the New York Times doesn't want to buy it for $20 million or whatever it was,
they're listening right now.
I'm definitely open to that. Maybe even $19 million if you want a deal. it's funny. We talked about, like, my wife and I were saying, you know, we don't really need to live any one given location. I think there are certain times of the year, like for bicycle trainer season, that I need to be in one place because people are sending me 50-pound packages to test these things. That's the fall. Like this past year, we went to Australia for all of January and just did some work from there because there was a big bike race down there, and then just kind of wandered around. And I think we'll do the same thing next year as well, probably for like a lot longer, because nobody really wants to be in Northern Europe in winter anyways. And so that's something that, we've kind of talked about, just living wherever we want to be for a couple months at a time.
I mean, it's amazing when you think about that as the future of media too. You're totally distributed. You're not tied to a specific newsroom. It's not like you have bureaus set up in time zones, but you're also covering a specific type of, you know, a specific vertical, specific type of content, but you can kind of go everywhere, go anywhere and everywhere.
I mean, just like the next 3 weeks or whatever it is I'm here in California for, it's just, I brought an extra large suitcase full of stuff, and you know, I certainly spent a lot of time thinking about exactly what I need for 3 weeks worth of content and beyond to make sure I have all the right gadgets for that. But once I'm here, I'm self-sufficient within that.
Will Robertson asks, can Apple Watch or the recent Android Wear watches such as Polar, New Balance, LG, etc., replace a dedicated running watch yet?
I think they can from a running standpoint. I think for some people they can, not everyone, but I think that, you know, if you don't really care about all the higher end, like infrastructure type pieces or structure training, that kind of stuff on a Garmin wearable or Suunto or whatever, then I think they can. And to be fair, like a lot of that same stuff exists on the Apple Watch in the form of third party apps. Like there are some amazing third party apps out there on the Apple Watch that do really cool stuff from a training standpoint and plans and all that kind of stuff. It just gets back to a little bit earlier we talked about, you know, the usability of that in tough workout environments, and whether that's swimming or it's running intervals at night around a track when it's pouring out and trying to use a touchscreen, that's where it's more difficult. If you're running 10K every other day around Central Park and only when it's sunny out and you're just at your own pace, then it's probably fine.
It's probably fine. Well, minus the really sunny part because display.
Yeah, display. But, you know, it's the thought that counts, which right. Nothing wrong with running around Central Park, by the way, on a sunny day. I love doing that too.
No, that sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Actually, Joe Cools responded to that question, said, no, try doing an Ironman with an Apple Watch.
Yeah.
Emoji.
Yeah, no way.
Sam Cash asks, what would be a killer sports app for the Apple Watch?
It seems like it has a lot.
Fair amount already.
I think it has most of what you need from a sports standpoint. I think the biggest challenge with any of the Android Wear, Apple Watch type scenarios is that you're having to get all these different apps. So, like, if you go out and get a Garmin or Polar or a Suunto, whatever you want that's fitness focused, all that stuff is by and large in that unit itself. Certainly, like Garmin has their Connect IQ for apps and whatnot, but the core of what you want to do is within that watch without having to download additional apps, which is kind of what you want in some ways on a wearable versus on a phone. Certainly, you want the ecosystem of apps and everything like that, but you want the core things to be there versus on an Apple Watch or an Android Wear watch. If you want to do something, you have to download an app for that. You have to find the best bike app, or you have to find the best running app or the best swimming app. And then does that work with the services that you want it to? And that's where it kind of gets a bit tougher, which on the flip side, that's flexibility. That's the ability to say, let's say Apple Watch's default running app sucks, to be able to say, no, we want to use something else and go off and use another company's. And that's great. You can do that. Versus on the Garmin side, you know, you're kind of tied, or in Suunto, you're tied to that particular app, or that functionality.
Yep, the core apps. Ian Berman asks, he says, to ask Ray about business travel tips for working out, device tracker algorithm assumptions and relevancy under the radar fit tech startups. Okay, these are three questions in one. First part's four parts. I like the first one. Let's focus on that. What are your tips for working out when you're traveling?
Just get it done. Just get it
just
done.
Just get it done.
Just go out and do it. Just especially like for me, get off the plane, and if you're not like falling over tired, just do it then. Just go out and run. Like I've gotten off of 14-hour flights and just gone out and run 20 miles. And yeah, you're going to feel crappy for the first mile or something, but you'll feel so much better at the end of it. And it's done. Like you're not thinking about it versus I feel like it's really easy when you're traveling to get into that rut of first day I was on the plane and this and that, and then the second day, well, I got busy with work, and before you know it, a week's gone by and you actually haven't done anything to keep yourself healthy, which that's like the one time that you should be healthy because you're eating crappy hotel food or eating out every night.
Dehydrated or... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just, I just get it done. I think at the same time, don't overthink the workouts. Like if you're training for a marathon or training for some event that you're really focused on structural workouts, in some ways that's the time to give yourself a break about structure and focus on maintaining fitness. Like, you know, you talk about building fitness levels and maintaining or losing fitness levels, depending on what you're looking at, kind of different categories. Don't overstress on trying to build your fitness level. Just maintain while you're traveling, and that's usually going to still help you so that when you get back, you're still healthy. You know, people, if you're traveling internationally or whatnot, you could get sick easily and traveling just in terms right. of fatigue and whatnot built. And if you try to go out and do, admittedly my example of a 20-mile run, then you could end up being sick versus just simply maintain. Like for me, traveling, I don't generally bother to swim because logistics are usually too messy to deal with trying to find the right swimming pool and are the hours right. And before you know it, you go to the swimming pool and the hours aren't what they posted, and then you've wasted an entire workout.
Right.
I don't generally try to do bikes when I'm traveling unless I'm somewhere for a long period of time, just because, again, I don't want to bring a bike somewhere. I don't want to deal with rentals. I just run or use a hotel bike if I need to, mm-hmm. To get the workout in. But I enjoy, like this morning I ran and just I went out at whatever it was just before sunrise, and it was great.
Mm-hmm. I would say my process is probably somewhat similar. I definitely never swim when I'm on the road. I definitely never bike when I'm on the road unless I'm like renting the bike for the day to go right along the beach type yep. thing. But running, yeah. But I tend to be a little bit more of my surroundings when I travel too. If I'm really unfamiliar with an area, I won't go mm-hmm. running outside. Mm-hmm. But even just doing intervals on a crappy hotel treadmill yep. is better than nothing.
Absolutely.
And even if you're going to be bored because maybe you forgot your favorite headphones or there's nothing, you're staring at a wall. I mean, doing intervals is just a great way to like keep it interesting and...
Yeah, absolutely. And then, like from a running, like finding places standpoint, you mentioned that like my two biggest tips are water and airports. So you can run along and around water almost every city on earth, and you can run around an airport in almost every city on earth, except for oddly enough here in San Francisco. Like they make great running routes. Like you can follow the perimeter road because almost every airport has a perimeter road, and it's almost, every time it's outside the fence, and so you can just run around it, and they're usually well lit, well secured. Like it's
a good tip.
Yeah.
So you're not that person that's like waking up and doing 1,000 burpees in your hotel room.
Not a chance. Nope.
I like that about you. Next question is from John Brubaker. Garmin makes such a big deal of quote unquote performance condition in their new watches. So why doesn't this integrate with other devices like Edge?
It's a good question. Mm-hmm. Likely because they license it. So they license it from First Beat, which is a Finnish heart rate analytics firm, and they probably don't want to pay licensing fee for the Edge devices.
Okay. So basically they're putting in their watches, but you're out of luck with the bike computer because it's more places for them to have to pay for it.
Yep.
All right. That was a good answer. Sam Mallory. Kara once said she wanted her fitness app to tell her how much to run. Is automated training, oh, by the way, shameless plug, that was an earlier podcast we did about which running app you should use. And you can find that in our archives. Sam asks, is automated training the future and can it be applied to running and swimming?
I think it's getting there. Like it's one app on the cycling side called Exert, X-E-R-T, is doing that now where they aren't necessarily telling you how long to run, or bike in this case, but they're changing duration on the fly while you're on the bike workout for your structured workout. So it's literally looking at you and saying you're doing this well or not well, and you're trying to achieve a certain amount of exertion points, essentially, in a very technical sense. And it's going to adjust your workout parameters on the fly. So add more intensity or add more duration to get you to this goal along the way. And so I think they're on the right track. And I think if you were to go forward into running other things like that, we'll probably definitely see that. It's getting very, very close. Certainly there are plenty of, I don't want to say automated coaching because that
sounds like micro coaching.
Yeah, like a lot of the problems, a lot of the companies will say, well, we got coaching plans and stuff, but mm-hmm. it's all pre-canned stuff. It's just simply they're picking an end date, they're picking an intensity level, and then they're spewing out pre-canned stuff. It's not actually looking at your stress levels or fatigue levels and stuff every day like a normal coach might do. And so if you have a running coach or something or a triathlon coach, and it's a good one anyway, if it's a good coach, they will give you that feedback back and say, oh, you're exhausted today, you're traveling, let me adjust your schedule accordingly, which most apps out there don't do. They just simply say soldier on.
Next question is from Marcos Don Juan. Great name. You should do a versus video, he says. Thank you, Marco. It's been a little while since I've done a versus video. I might have to revive that. Question now. What will be the next big thing for sport watches after refined OHR optical heart rate? What's the next?
Your Versus videos are great, by the way. I can't imagine how much time they take.
We've gotten them down to a science, my twin and I. but we actually haven't done one now since late last year. So we're waiting for the right moment.
Yeah.
We're going to have some new video stuff coming soon. Thank you, though. Yes. I really appreciate it.
So next big thing, I think it gets back to some of the automated coaching stuff. I think we're seeing a lot of focus by a lot of companies, Garmin, Fitbit, and others, on using, you know, HRV, so heart rate variability data, and RR intervals to start looking at what your body is doing under the covers, and trying to give you suggestions on how to improve your day-to-day life, your workouts, and that's really the direction to go. And certainly, there's a little bit of voodoo magic when it comes to HRV data. It's one of those things that I can look at HRV data from four different straps at once and get totally different answers, which can really matter because the nuances of HRV data are so big that, you know, a tiny change is actually a huge change on the recommendation side. Still, I think they're trending the right way. What Garmin just released this week with the new Vivo Smart 3, is actually impressive on the stress tracking front. I mean, to try that out and go, wow, it's actually nailing my stress levels throughout the day, and they're measuring it on a per second basis, basically constantly, and then to look at the end of the day and go, dang, that actually mirrored what my stress level was throughout the day, is impressive. And then to figure out how they could then integrate that within coaching, for example, to look at that and go, you know, just like, a coach would, to say, you had an incredibly stressful 2 days at work. Why don't you just take the day off, sort of thing?
So with stress, you're actually referring to day-to-day stress,
training load stress. Okay. Yeah, so not that.
So just, yeah. But isn't on some level that sort of subjective as well? I mean, you Absolutely. Could look back and say, oh, I remember I was stressed because I was in a heated phone call with, yep. well, I was going to say your boss, but you're your own boss,
yeah.
or whatever mm-hmm. it might be, you know, during that time period. And then you look at your spikes in heart rate and you're thinking, okay, that must be accurate. But it's really hard to know.
It's tough to know. It's tough. It's something that you have to look at each day and go, was that accurate or not? And kind of make those judgment calls. And then does it matter too? Like, was that, so I think the example this weekend, my highest stress point was actually sitting in traffic where we were late to a friend's birthday party or something, about like a long time late. And the traffic was all closed down for, ironically, the Paris Marathon. And so, you know, we spent like 50 minutes going somewhere. It should have taken us 10. And to see that stress level and go, okay, yes, it was super stressful according to my watch for that period of time, but did that actually have an impact on my day? And then at the end of it, the site, Garmin site, says, no, it didn't. My day was considered was, quote, calm. And so it's tough to be able to balance that and figure out, is that useful guidance or non-useful guidance? And I think they're on the right track. It's just going to take time and to figure out, you know, how to turn what is general lifestyle stress into training stress, because they're two different things. Like, for a lot of people, to relieve that training or that lifestyle stress, you go out and train. People go out for a run to wash away that. So to be able to find a balance to say, is that training going to help or hurt you in an overall fatigue standpoint?
The holy grail for a lot of these companies is really figuring out a way to take all this data. I mean, it still feels like we're in the very earliest days of all of this massive data gathering.
So much.
And there's not one company yet that has quite figured out the right balance between privacy and giving up data that you need, you know, providing recommendations that feel personal in real time and all of that. Doing everything accurate. I mean, some companies seem to do well with optical heart rate, but then you wonder about the accuracy of sleep tracking, and obviously sleep plays an important role. But it's all kind of moving that way. It's just, it's definitely not there yet. We're not there yet.
No, it's all like compartmentalized right now. You capture a ton of data and it maybe gives you like a summary the next day or something, but it's not real time yet, which I think is the changing point. Like right now, you may get your like Fitbit or Garmin or whatever summary at the end of the day that's like, good job, you did more steps, or good job, this is more than your average. Like, or it tries to add some sort of like pseudo big data twist on it. Like, oh, this is more than most people of this gender. And it's like, okay, great. But what does that actually tell me? Versus I want a watch to tell me at like 4 o'clock, so I'm getting ready to go home or whatever, to say, hey, you know, this day was a pretty calm day. Let's up your run from this to this. Like,
right. Like saying, oh, you know, you're better than 35% of females aged 30 to 39 is not big data.
No, it's not.
It's a sophisticated AI.
Yeah, it's like everyone wants chart. To use AI and big data as their buzzwords for everything, right? And
right.
It's not like, do something legit with that. Like, find a way to make use of all that data. And I think that's where all these companies are really failing, in terms of not just give me a cute infographic, but find a way to look at my trending over time and figure out what I'm doing and how can I make it better.
Right. Okay. So that, Marco, that's going to be the next big thing, but we're not there yet. The next question is from PJ Washer, who asks, is there such a thing as too many races? Does he have a certain number of races he targets to do each year? What's your goal each year?
I don't have like a certain number of races. Definitely, there's definitely something as too many races. There are, yeah, if you do too many races, you're not going to actually train. You're just recovering from races. So you're not, certainly people, like I know some folks that will try to do like one a weekend or whatever in the peak of the season. I think if you get to the end of the season, it's fun just to like do races for the sake of races. Like if you're talking like the fall, if you're a triathlete, for example, you know, that season generally ends around September. And then sometimes, depending on where you live in the world, if you're in a warmer place, you can get that in like October and maybe early November to do that. And yeah, people just go out and have fun and race sprint tries or whatever for a couple weekends in a row. That's great. I think if you're legitimately trying to train for an event and trying to PR or have your personal record that event, then for me, it's once a month is kind of the in season. And, you know, you got to decide what that is. But I think for me, like starting in May or April, depending on where you live in the world, again, from a temperature standpoint, from triathlon, but whereas running for winter is perfectly fine too. And so a lot of people do races running wise throughout the winter. But I wouldn't necessarily say I want to have like 12 races a year. I think that's probably a lot. I think you want to have like a legit training block that you're focused on training. And, but at the same time, you want to have races to be able to know what racing's like.
Right. Okay. So one a month. And yes, it's possible to do too many. I mean, one a month is, you're saying you wouldn't want to do 12 a year.
I would not want to do 12 a year. But I think if you're in season one a month, like in a triathlon world, you might start now this time of year in April and do like a shorter distance one. And then next month do a, like you could do a sprint this month as kind of a, just work out the kinks of your equipment this year and all that kind of stuff. And then in May, you might do an Olympic. And then, you know, if you were to continue on, if you're training for an Ironman that was in the summer, you would do a half Iron in June or July, and then finally an Ironman in August. And the same is true of racing a marathon. If you had a marathon in, say, October, you might do a half marathon in September. You'd probably do some 10Ks throughout the summer, that kind of stuff. You want them to align with your training progression, your training plan. You don't want a race to take away from your training plan too much. It should just fit in there nicely as a good kind of thing along the way.
Yeah, something that keeps you going.
Yep.
Something that keeps you motivated. This question is from Big Guy Running. I think he's a swimmer. Paris, great city. What made you choose that? Also, tech test that got you the most stares, shaking my heads, or just simply embarrassing? That's a good question. So why'd you end up in Paris? What was your most embarrassing test?
So yeah, the company I was working for at the time, that was, they kind of gave me the choice. I could live really anywhere within EMEA, so Europe, Middle East, or Africa. And so we narrowed it down to Paris and Cape Town, South Africa. I just had to be near a big airport. That was the only requirement for the job. I was just near a big airport and willingness to travel. And so the only problem with Cape Town for me was that every week would start off with an 8-hour flight. It would be back up to the Middle East or to Europe, and there'd be occasional times in South Africa, but there wasn't a lot of big data center activity, like 10,000 server type activity in South Africa. So Paris kind of won. Like we love it from a food standpoint. It's got a great food scene and cultural scene. And I didn't speak a single word of French when I moved there, but it was all good. And so, yeah, we enjoy it there. It's nice to be at such a walkable city, to be able to just go anywhere you want to go and walk and ride around. It's really nice.
And the next question was, what was the tech test that got you the most stares?
I think there's two different ones. One we mentioned earlier with all the bike computers. So going in the Alps with 14 bike computers got me a lot of stares. But I think probably the most was actually a heads-up display from Recon Instruments, the Recon Jet, which is like a sport-focused one. Running that around the Louvre in Paris, so many stares. People just looking, there's two of us running at the time, one of the company guys and me, and I was just taking them on a run throughout the city and testing this out for the first time running. And it's not like Google Glass style, like you can kind of, you don't notice it. Like Google Glass, you don't notice if you're a little ways away from the person. With this, you definitely noticed it. People like looking at you with this huge heads-up display in your face, and we ran right through around the Pyramid of the Louvre there, and every single person was looking at us. And so that was definitely like the most. And it wouldn't matter if it was a tourist in that area or the French people, even worse, was just like, what are you doing? Come on.
If you were in San Francisco, you would have been right at home.
Yeah.
People would have been like, oh, hello. Welcome you.
Totally fine. Yeah. That was one of those days that I would just say, my wife and I joke, just saying, we're going to be American that day, right? That was like some days I'm like, okay, I'm going to dress more, whatever you want to call it, to be like dress nicer, I guess. Like we come back here, people are like, why are you guys dressing so nice? And today, by the way, is not that day. Today I'm in t-shirt and jeans. I'm going American today. But, you know, that's definitely a day of like just I don't care. I'm just dressing like an American and calling it done.
And you have a review of that on your site, right?
I do, Recon, yeah.
Yep. Recon Jet?
Recon Jet,
yeah. Yep. Okay, so everyone should go check that out so they can see pictures of Wright wearing the goofy headset. I have another question for you, actually. I don't think we have any more reader questions, so I'm going to steal this one. I mentioned privacy earlier. Are you ever worried about your health data, all of your health data being in multiple clouds and apps and services, considering how much you test this stuff?
You know, not too much for me. I think I'm kind of the point where if they want to know my heart rate, then shrug. Like I get why people are worried about it. I get there's lots of stuff, and I think where it gets sketchier. So let me try. I'm trying to, how to like phrase this carefully. So there was a company recently that I'm working on a review for, not for, but about, and
you find out they have access to your data
in
because
nutshell.
because they reference something, and you're like, how would you know that unless you were in my account?
That's even worse, actually. Before. So yeah, so they like I don't mind companies that I'm writing a review on looking at my data and saying, hey, there's something wrong. We're seeing whatever. Like I'm fine with that. I don't think it's normal for a normal consumer, but if we have like a relationship where I've given them the okay to let me know what's wrong, I'm fine with that. But in this case, this company on the privacy agreement says that they're not selling their data and all this kind of stuff, and they are. And it's one of those things where, and they're selling it in a really unique way that I've never seen before. And it's not a bad way. Like it's, if they were upfront about it, they were doing something where you bought their product and then they would tell the retailer your usage of that product so that that retailer could then pitch you more products to go after that product. So if you use through this one product, you can then go buy another one, a new clothes or new running shoes, whatever you want, because you had run X number of miles or something like that. And so you sat there and went, okay, that's an interesting business proposition that they have to be able to offer that to a retailer and all that kind of stuff. And if they wanted to do that, where Amazon automatically sent me a new pair of running shoes after 500 miles because it knows that I need those new pair of running shoes, that's fine, but I should know about that. I should know that that's happening behind the scenes. This should be an opt-in thing, not a it's happening there, especially since their privacy agreement said it wasn't happening. Their FAQ said it wasn't happening. And then I get like a little birdie email from a retailer saying, hey, do you know this is going on?
So and you found out because just that happened or because you read it somewhere in fine print?
So I found out because a retailer emailed me on the side saying, hey, just so you know, they're actually pitching data, pitching sales of data. So they want to sell your data to the retailer. The retailer in turn comes back and gets access to your actual data, not like your legit data with all your personal information, all that kind of stuff. And to me, that crosses a line in terms of, A, if your agreements and all this kind of stuff in the fine print, I went through the fine print in detail, say that you don't do that. And then you do share the data and not just like blanket share, but share it with your name and contact information and with the intent purpose to sell you things. To me, that's crossing a huge line. No matter how cool that concept is, like if you want to execute on that business concept, then great, but you need to be upfront with people about it. And the thing is, like in that particular scenario, I would actually be fine with it. Like if Amazon wanted to ship me a new pair of running shoes every 500 miles, because that's when you should usually replace running shoes, then that's great. That'd be awesome. It just automatically knows, like in a Siri, not Siri, in a Alexa kind of way, but I need to be in control of that. And so that's something that annoys me a lot. And I've got an upcoming review about that.
So you are going to write about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And you're going to name the company.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've certainly confronted the company about it, and they've given me some details on what they are or aren't doing. But
are they quickly changing their language?
Yeah.
they are.
Yeah.
And you're taking screen grabs all along the way.
Absolutely. But, and I think, you know, it's tough because obviously this is a startup company of sorts, and I don't want to say this will kill them because they're offering an incredibly compelling product, an incredibly compelling price point, but they just need to be upfront about it. And so that's something that to me like annoys me to no end. On the flip side, like if a company like Fitbit or someone else, you know, wants to look at my data, not from a PII standpoint, but from a looking at trends and stuff like that, I'm generally all right with that. I'm less all right if they're selling my name attached to my data, though I think, I guess with all the hack-ins and stuff like that happen, the break-ins and hacks that happen these days, I just presume my data in a cloud-type scenario is generally unsecure.
Right. I tend to be okay with sending companies screen grabs of my experiences if I say, oh, you know, I ran this number of miles and your tracker and therefore your app is only showing that I ran this number of miles or at this pace or for whatever reason the data isn't syncing properly. All of that, I'm 100% fine sending a series of screen grabs. It's generally what I do. But I don't like to give the companies sort of like a just a pass to get into, you know, they'll say, oh, can we help you troubleshoot? Tell us what emails associated with your account. We're going to dig into your account and we're going to look into this. And I just say no, because I just don't want companies having sort of carte blanche, like, mm-hmm. just go do this, you know, in my account. And I also feel like, especially with startups, less established companies, but more with startups, a lot of times their products basically ship when they're still in beta. I mean, they just don't work well, or there's something funky going on, or they really need a firmware update or whatever it might be. And sometimes they'll try to say, like, well, it's because you're doing this, or it's because you're doing this. And I'm like, listen, it's not. Your thing's not working properly. Yep. Okay. And no amount of me, like, sharing my personal data with you is going to change that.
Exactly.
It's only going to sort of give you the ability to, like, point out areas where
a circle going down the drain sort of thing, right? Of it's, you know, finger pointing back and forth, and it's like, no, it just simply doesn't work. And there's no way around it.
Right. If I show you the same exact experience that hundreds of other consumers are having in their app, and mine looks like theirs, that's all the data you need from me. That's all you need to know.
Yeah, I think you want to get to the point where you can validate that it's not you, that it's at fault or something. Like, it's not just a stupid Ray thing or a stupid Lauren thing where you're like, oh, I did this the wrong way, right? Because there's nothing that frustrates me more than, like, seeing a journalist publish something on a site that's just factually incorrect. Not like an innocent mistake, but like they used the product the wrong way and then said the product was horrible, and you're like, no, you did it wrong, or that's not, you just fundamentally did it wrong. And so that's something that it's a really tough balance to find those two.
Absolutely. Okay. So what's next for you with DC Rainmaker? What's your big vision?
I don't have a big vision. I don't know. Like, people, it's funny. A lot of people ask, they're like, oh, what's the big plan? I'm like, aside from the New York Times buying it for $19 million, 18.5 is still an option, by the way. I don't have, like, a big, I keep doing it. You know, my wife and I were talking about it, and it's like, yes, I could go and hire people and make it bigger and, you know, maybe make it a $20 million sell, that sort of thing. But it's not really what I want. Like, I got to the point where I enjoy that I run almost all of it now by myself, and it's something that I have complete control over. I'm not dealing with employees and stuff like that. I have people that need, you know, as me, like the grammar guy and stuff like that. But I don't have to think about it from a day-to-day standpoint, like, and in terms of a day-to-day, like, a business standpoint. I don't know what the right word is. I don't have to overthink it as something that, like, drags on me from a business perspective. It's just, I enjoy being about my life and being about the gear I test, and it works out, and I don't need to make millions of dollars from it. And, you know, unless, again, $20 million comes around, but it's one of those, I'm just enjoying the way it is. Like, I was listening to Tim Ferriss or something recently, and they were talking to some guest about that. Like, a lot of people in that startup phase where they, especially individuals that are, you know, become successful by themselves, like a Casey Neistat or whatever, or kind of what I'm doing, where you get to the point where it's all about trying to be bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And at some point you stop along the way and you realize you no longer have control of whatever you've done, or you're just not enjoying life anymore because you're spending so much time appeasing everyone else, or, you know, trying to get bigger and bigger and bigger, to what end? So I'm good with who I am right now. It's not bad.
And not that I would ever want this to happen, but what happens if you ever, you know, get injured or need to take a serious break? I mean, how would you keep the testing going? How would you keep the site going?
I don't know. It's tough. Like, that's a legit concern. Like, it's in some ways, I'm no different than a pro athlete, right? If I get injured, that really slows things down a lot or hurts things, especially if it's for a long period of time. I think that's kind of, you've seen some of my focus on different areas of sports tech. So whether it be action cameras or stuff like that may not necessarily need me to be running every day, or even like with focusing on drones, stuff like that lately, that are in a sports way, not like in a general fly a drone around, take pictures way, but in a, how does a drone follow a person autonomously, and does that work well from a sporting standpoint? So kind of diversifying things and understanding that, yeah, there will be a time. I've been really lucky that I haven't gotten injured, but I'm sure there'll be a time and a date where I do get injured and can't do testing for a period of time. And so how to make sure that the content on the site can work around that.
Looks like you'll have to contract some people to do some
designated
running.
Designated runners, yep.
Yeah. Or you have to clone yourself. That technology might be coming up. So,
definitely. It should be tomorrow, I think.
Well, Ray, it's been amazing to have you in studio. Thank you so much. I'm glad you're here in San Francisco and we were able to make this work.
Yeah, it's been great. A lot of fun.
And For those of you who have not yet been to Rayside, I highly recommend that you go visit it. It is dcrainmaker.com. Is that correct?
Yep.
And indeed. You're on Twitter?
I'm on Twitter. And we actually have a podcast as well. It's
And what's your podcast called?
The DC Rainmaker podcast. It's very complicatedly named. But yeah, it's basically like kind of what we did for the last half an hour. It's just tech questions. It's purely folks that have sports tech gadget questions can call in and essentially try to stump me. And it's kind of fun.
I'm sure the questions you get on that podcast are much more kind of granular.
They're incredibly granular sometimes, yeah. But they're all over the map. It's sort of like these, right? They're all over the map, and sometimes they're incredibly granular, like just amazingly deep in terms of well thought out. It's cool. Like there's some people that have really thought about stuff, and again, it ranges a large audience from people that are just trying to train for a 5K, and that means just in a bad way, but just that's what they're focused on is a 5K versus, again, Olympians or whatever else that are trying to, like, how do you push the boundaries of this, or a pro team or something like that? How do you do something really off the edge? So
cool. And you can check that out on iTunes, all the usual suspects.
All the usual, yep.
All right. I don't know about you, but this has been a really fun episode of Too Embarrassed to Ask. Kara, we missed you. Ray, thanks again for coming by. If you all enjoyed the episode as much as we did, be sure to subscribe to the show, and you can leave us a review. Go to itunes.com/tooembarrassedtoask. And do leave us a review if you have the time, because we read them and we really appreciate them. If you're not on iTunes, you can also subscribe on Google Play Music. We're on TuneIn, Stitcher, we're on SoundCloud, or just go to recode.net/podcasts, and you can find all of our podcasts there. You can find Kara's show, Recode Decode, Peter's show, Recode Media, and of course, The Verge has The Vergecast and Control Walt Delete with none other than Walt Mossberg himself, who just called in on today's show. But most importantly, send us the tech questions that you've been too embarrassed to ask, and thanks for listening. Thanks also to Digital Media, the company that distributes this show, including Beth O'Connell and our editor, Chris Basil. And thank you to Eric Johnson, our producer. We'll be back next week to answer more of the questions that you've been too embarrassed to ask, so tune in then.